Hello and welcome to our micronutrients presentation on sulfur. Sulfur is a mineral and we are going to talk about it. And it's a really important one and I think it's well overlooked. There's not even a chapter on sulfur in our textbook, which I found quite shocking given all the amazing things that sulfur does in our body and all the functions. So we're going to talk about sulfur and I'm going to share some really cool stuff with you and stuff that's going to be clinically relevant, as well as some maybe some new stuff that you've never even considered sulfur being important for. So I want to just make sure that you're aware that everything we talk about is not a diagnosis, it's not treatment, it's all about sharing of information, and that's how you approach your clients when you're talking to them, especially about nutrients, that you're not diagnosing them and saying the reason that they have this particular issue is because of an XYZ deficiency. It's that you're educating them as to how to restore balance to their body. So let's just jump right in and talk about sulfur. Well, its atomic number is 16, and it's the third most abundant mineral in the entire body after calcium and phosphorus. So you would think that it would get a place on stage like calcium and phosphorus do in some of the textbooks, but very important, and we're going to share some really cool information about it. It's actually the sixth most abundant macro mineral in breast milk. And if something is very abundant in breast milk, to me, that says that it's super important, right? It's important for growing fetus. Then it's an important piece of someone's health. The oxidized, which is the inorganic form of sulfur, is sulfate. An important thing for producing sulfate is sunlight, vitamin D3 from the sunlight. So the sunlight triggers the production of vitamin D3 by the conversion in the skin, the activation in the liver and kidneys. Remember all that from our vitamin D presentation. And it's an important nutrient in producing sulfate. Vitamin D, as you recall, is important for lots of different reactions in the body. It's considered one of the six building blocks of life, along with oxygen, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus. So it is a key player, and we're going to get into a lot more detail about it today. So what are the sulfur-containing amino acids? Well, there's a whole bunch of them. Methionine, cysteine, homocysteine, and taurine. And we've gone through, we have details about each of these and what they're good for and what they're dangerous for in other parts of our macro and micronutrient presentations. And we'll go into a little bit more with the homocysteine in terms of methylation pathways in vitamin B12 and B6 and folate. So there are sulfur-containing enzymes in the body. There's actually quite a few, and there's quite a few of really biologically active sulfur-containing compounds. Sulfur is important for detoxification. It's important for antioxidants. It's required for the proper structure and biological activity of most enzymes. Biologically active enzymes are required for metabolic processes, right? We have to have these enzymes to speed up the metabolic processes. Sulfur is an important part of the mother of all antioxidants. Sorry, guys, I'm talking about it being the mother rather than the father, but it's glutathione, super important. It's a sulfur-based antioxidant. And then another one called thioredoxin, which is important in the thyroid gland. So let's take a look at what sulfur actually does in the body, and that the reason for giving you the details is why, right? So that you can be looking at your clients and seeing, is it possible that they have an issue with sulfur? Do they have enough sulfur in the body? Do they have too much sulfur in the body? So I want you to be able to understand why it's important. And there's a lot of detox formulas that add in some sulfur, usually along with methyl groups. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. What does it do? Well, it's important in the electron transport system as part of the iron-sulfur proteins in the mitochondria. Remember, the electron transport system is part of the mitochondria for producing energy. It's also important for thiamine and biotin conversions for their active forms and essential for converting the the carbohydrates into energy, into ATP. Sulfur is important for synthesizing important metabolic intermediates like glutathione. Well, if you look at the pathways, we think of glutathione as this be-all and end-all, but it's actually part of a whole pathway, and we'll look at what that is in a little bit. Sulfur is actually also important for insulin structure and function. It's the sulfur bridges that take two amino acid chains and put them together to make insulin. It's important, as we said, for detoxification in addition to the glutathione, but also in the sulfation pathways and part of phase two liver detoxification. It also enables the transport of oxygen across cell membranes. So sulfur is not a slouch. Sulfur does a lot of important things in the body, and it's important to be aware of these. Other things that sulfur does, it causes bonds between proteins to maintain the shape. And the shape of certain proteins and other chemicals helps with the biological activity. So when you change the shape of a particular molecule, you can change the biological activity. We know that for sure when we talk about fats. That's the one that comes to mind mostly, is trans fats versus cis forms of fats. And that change in the shape actually creates problems in the body, in that the trans forms are not the shape that the body's expecting and can cause damage to tissue. Keratin, which is a protein that forms like the structure, the strength in our hair and nails, is high in sulfur. Connective tissue and cartilage contain proteins that have sulfur bonds, and these are flexible sulfur bonds so that connective tissue can be strong but flexible and mobile. Sulfur maintains the elasticity of soft tissue, prevents the sagging and wrinkling of skin. So if you see someone who is prematurely wrinkled, might be that they don't have enough sulfur in their diet and in their body. It can create stiffening of the muscles and painful joints when we don't have enough sulfur. And we see this especially as people age and are quote-unquote expected to be falling apart, that it could be a sulfur deficiency that can help people to maintain a more youthful look and a more youthful feel to the body. And the structure of sulfur allows for a variety of different oxidation states, and oxidation states are important in different chemical reactions. So there's a lot of things that sulfur is important for. We want to be aware of this as you're doing an evaluation, as you're looking at your clients and asking them questions and having them fill out questionnaires. Sulfur wants to come to mind. So let's talk about absorption. Well, the sulfur in the diet is actually poorly absorbed. It's absorbed in the small intestine as the four sulfur-containing amino acids, the main ones. So that's the methionine, cysteine, cysteine, and taurine. So those four. Homocysteine and homocysteine are not, they're not nutrients. They're not needed nutritionally. They're needed in pathways. They're intermediates. But the four main amino acids that contain sulfur, methionine, cysteine, cysteine, and taurine, they are not absorbed real well, and they're absorbed in the small intestine, okay? Most things are absorbed in the small intestine, but a few of our nutrients that we studied actually are absorbed further up in the stomach. Some of them are further down in the large intestine or in the transition. Sulfate is produced by the oxidation of the sulfur-containing amino acids. Sulfite is a common food preservative. It's a non-nutritive form of sulfur. Okay, so sulfites are preservatives. That's when you eat dried fruit, like dried apricots or something, and they look bright orange or yellow. That's actually the sulfites that are preserving the color. Those are not good for people, and a lot of folks have impairment in their sulfation pathways so that it's hard for them to eliminate the sulfites, and they get bad reactions when they eat fruits or other foods that have been preserved with sulfites. There are particular SNPs that control that. Sulfite oxidase is a molybdenum-dependent enzyme that breaks down your sulfites. So if a person doesn't have enough of the sulfite oxidase, maybe they have a SNP that's causing them to not make as much, they cannot break down sulfites. And it's important that we have enough molybdenum in order to get rid of those. Molybdenum is a trace mineral we study. Sulfites can trigger asthma and food and chemical sensitivities in some people, not in everyone. So it's not one of these universal, wow, this is bad, like heterocyclic amines in various exhausts and charbroiled meats. Those are bad for everybody, but for some people it's worse than others. For sulfites, it's really more of an allergy or chemical sensitivity that causes people not to be able to break it down. So let's look a little bit at the sulfur metabolism. So there's a bunch of pathways that are linked together. I'm going to look at a picture in just a moment that links these together. So picture methionine. Picture a circle, and at the top is methionine. Methionine is degraded down to homocysteine. It lets go of a methyl group, passes it on to S-adenosyl methionine, who is the principal methyl donor in the body, SAMe. So passes on that methyl group, and then from there we have remaking of homocysteine. Now homocysteine can then grab the methyl group again going up the circle. So think about methionine at the top of the circle, homocysteine at the bottom, SAMe over on the right hand as you're facing it, and on the left side is where the methylation comes in, the folate pathway, so folate and B12. So homocysteine can convert it back to methionine if there's enough vitamin B12 and folate to donate a methyl group and reform methionine. Methionine then lets go of its methyl group, gives it to SAMe. SAMe then distributes it around the body for helping DNA repair, for helping liver stage 2 detoxification, and so many other things. And then we regenerate homocysteine. Homocysteine can also be degraded down in what's called the transsulfuration pathway and made into cystathione, which then gets reduced to cysteine, which then can be a precursor to glutathione. If you've ever heard of something called N-acetylcysteine, NAC, it's used as a really great substance to help to generate glutathione in the body, to help with the antioxidant status of the body. So that's basically the pathway in words. Now, for those of you who are better with pictures, let's take a look at the picture. So here's a picture of sulfur metabolism. At the bottom of the circle, we have homocysteine, and at the top, we have methionine. The homocysteine then is converted to methionine when it goes through and grabs methyl groups from folate and vitamin B12. Gets converted and goes up to the top as methionine. The methionine then gets converted into S-adenosyl methionine, which is also known as SAMe. SAMe is the principal methyl donor. It takes the methyl group, does its thing with it, and makes it active in the body for DNA repair and red blood cell production and so much more, and then comes back around and regenerates homocysteine. So here's the deal. You've heard of homocysteine. We've talked about it before in other nutrients. Homocysteine can be toxic in high levels. So if you look at blood levels, you want to keep it below 10, ideally below 8, so say 6 to 8. When the homocysteine builds up because we don't have enough B12 or folate, then the homocysteine builds up and it can be damaging to blood vessel linings and to the neurology in the body. So homocysteine is important to keep recycling around. So for people who have an MTHFR mutation or people who have an MTR or MTRR SNP, they don't have enough methylated folate or methylated B12, they're going to get a buildup of homocysteine. The other way homocysteine can be degraded is to go down into the transsulfation pathway, and it goes and gets converted to cystathionine and then cysteine. And cysteine is a precursor to glutathione. So homocysteine is very important because it's basically an indirect precursor for glutathione. So if we have too much homocysteine here, we're thinking there's either a backup in the pathway going up and around to methionine or the pathway going down to glutathione. Either way, it's not a pretty picture. So we want homocysteine to be just right. So we need to have good levels of vitamin B12 and folate and good methylation in order for homocysteine to be converted to methionine. We also need good levels of B6 and molybdenum in order for homocysteine to be taken down and eventually converted into glutathione. So that's the picture of sulfur metabolism. You can see that methionine is involved and cysteine is involved and the S-adenosyl methionine is involved, and the sulfur has an important function here. So that's that. Let's look at the next piece. So we have to excrete sulfur whenever there's excess. We have to excrete everything, right? The way that sulfur is excreted is to be converted to sulfate and then be secreted. This arises predominantly from the catabolism breakdown, right? Catabolism, catabolic state, is a breakdown state of methionine and cysteine. So cysteine and methionine get broken down. These are amino acids that are essential amino acids that we have to have in our diet, and they get broken down, and the sulfur then gets excreted. Sulfate and taurine are the two main sulfur-containing end products, excreted almost entirely in the urine. So excess sulfur gets excreted in the urine, and one of the ways it gets excreted is sulfate. One of them is taurine. Taurine is an amino acid, and it gets converted to GABA. So taurine is very important for maintaining anxiety levels or reducing anxiety levels in your clients. It gets converted to GABA. Urinary sulfur or urinary inorganic sulfate and taurine measurement is a simple way to look at sulfur amino acid catabolism, and in some situations, whole body amino acids. So we can look at the urinary excretion of either sulfur or sulfate or taurine to determine what the level of breakdown of sulfur amino acids is. And if somebody is into a catabolic state where they're breaking down their body tissue and breaking down their protein into amino acids, we want to be able to know that. Not a common thing that we measure in urine, but if there's a suspicion that there's something going on. Something like the organic acid test, which we will get into more detail in going through in the organic acid module, but the organic acid test will test the urine for metabolites. So it will look at the homocysteine. You'll be able to look at the taurine. You'll be able to look at the sulfur-containing amino acids, as well as a whole bunch of other things. So storage of sulfur, where is it stored? Well, cysteine and methionine are not actually stored. They come in, they're used, they're transient, and they go. They're involved in these metabolic pathways, but they're not actually stored anywhere in the body. Excess sulfur is oxidized to sulfate and excreted, reabsorbed, and then stored in the form of glutathione. So it can be either excreted in the urine or reabsorbed or stored in the form of glutathione. Okay? So excess sulfur is oxidized to sulfate and excreted in the urine, or it's reabsorbed and utilized, or it's stored in the form of glutathione. So glutathione is a storage form of sulfur. In extreme situations, the loss of sulfur is spared by continuing to store any of the available sulfur as glutathione in the liver. So even if there's an extreme deficiency, we're going to not let go, or extreme excess, or some other extreme situation, sulfur is going to be stored as glutathione in the liver, assuming all those pathways are open and we have all the necessary cofactors. So what affects sulfur absorption? Well, the things that decrease absorption are some drugs like acetaminophen. Low methionine are going to decrease the absorption. Low cysteine. Some genetic SNPs like CBS and MTHFR are going to decrease the absorption of sulfur. High calcium, high copper, those are both going to get in the way. Pangamic acid, which some people refer to as vitamin B16. Mercury, which, of course, we have in thimerosal and preservatives that are used in vaccines, hopefully not much anymore. And also used to be in the contact lens solutions. There was a lot of that. So a lot of people still have mercury in their teeth, and it's outgassing. That's going to decrease the sulfur absorption, which is ironic because you need sulfur to be able to excrete toxic levels of metals And then aluminum, which again is in, is people eat, use aluminum cookware, they eat, drink out of aluminum cans. There's aluminum in the vaccines now. Now that they've taken a lot of the mercury out, they still have aluminum in there. The things that will increase the absorption of sulfur are amino acids, so moderate amounts of amino acids. We don't want to have too much amino acids, like too much protein, because that can inhibit the absorption of sulfur. So, but you have to have the right amount or you're not going to absorb the sulfur as well as you should. Vitamin D3, that helps. That's great. Vitamin B1, selenium, sodium, B12, and molybdenum. All of these help to increase the absorption of sulfur in the body. So let's look at some of the things that can actually deplete sulfur. These are things that have been shown to deplete the body's store of sulfur, to prevent the body from storing more glutathione, et cetera. So gluten, you know, we know gluten is inflammatory. We know a lot of things about it, but in addition to all the things we've already studied about gluten, it actually depletes sulfur. Whenever we eat or a person eats synthetic sulfites and things like dried fruits, the maraschino cherries, those pretty things I used to, that was my only cherries I ever had when I was a kid. Beer and wine, processed vegetable juices, teas, condiments, trail mix, canned vegetables, white rice, all of these things can have synthetic sulfites in it, which can deplete the body's store of sulfur. Alcohol, we see alcohol depleting a lot of things, including B vitamins, as well as sulfur. Herbicides, pesticides, all the refined sugars and artificial sweeteners. Stress levels, nitrates and nitrites, which deplete glutathione. Additives in the food, excess zinc and excess vitamin D. So we saw that vitamin D helps with the absorption of sulfur, but excess of it depletes it. So, you know, a lot of the body works on what I like to call the Goldilocks principle, right? Not too little, not too much, but just right. Unfortunately, when we're dealing with clients, a lot of them go by the more is better. If little is good, more is better concept, and people tend to overdo, and they read about something, they take it, they think they can take a lot of it, and they can get into trouble. So little is good, more is not better necessarily. So we have the double-edged sword of certain nutrients can actually inhibit as well as support the absorption utilization of certain nutrients. So vitamin D is one. We talked a little bit earlier about how protein affects sulfur. Too much is not good, too little is not good. So let's look at the interaction between sulfur and some of the other nutrients. Sulfur can interfere with the storage of copper. So, you know, if somebody's out there and they found the MSM supplement, for example, methyl sulfonyl methane, okay, it's a great supplement, has methyl groups, has sulfur, super for supporting phase 2 liver detox. But people just look at it like it's green powder and just glob it on and take a lot of it. Well, the excess sulfur might interfere with their storage of copper. Now, if there's a reason the person needs a lot of sulfur, then make sure that you're supplementing with extra copper or getting them on higher copper foods to make it up. Good thing, sulfur lowers aluminum levels. There's been talk of aluminum can affect the central nervous system. It's been implicated in some cases with Alzheimer and the ability to form neurofibrillary tangles. So sulfur actually lowers aluminum levels, so that's good. But sulfur can be a calcium antagonist and a potassium antagonist. So we want to make sure that we're getting the right amounts. And again, if there is a real reason to giving somebody a large amount of sulfur, to make sure that you're also supporting them in the calcium and potassium as well as copper. Sulfur-containing amino acids can use to increase the synthesis of SAMe, that's S-adenosylmethionine, glutathione, taurine, and NAC, which is N-acetylcysteine. What's the best time? People always ask that. Do they ask you that all the time? They ask me that all the time. When should I take this? Can I take it with this? What can I take it with? This is a great slide for, like, if they want to take MSM, what's the best time to take it with? Don't take it with calcium. Don't take it with potassium. Don't take it with copper. Okay? Take it any time of day, actually. It's best with food. So they could take their MSM powder and stick it in a smoothie, and that's fine. But just don't add extra of the other nutrients to it. Sulfur is important in the metabolism of glucose. We already talked about how sulfur bonds are what hold the two amino acid chains together to form insulin. can exist in several distinctive oxidative states, ranging from a plus 6 in what's called the sulfate radical to a minus 2 in the hydrogen sulfide form. Glucose can cause glycation damage to exposed proteins, leading to the formation of advanced glycation end products that are extremely destructive to health. When you have enough of the plus 6 sulfur levels in the body, that glucose is diverted to reducing the sulfur rather than glycating the protein. So you've probably heard about advanced glycation end products. We know that glucose can glycosylate different tissues. We measure glycosylated hemoglobin, of course, protein in the body. And so if we want to prevent that, we can actually use extra sulfur, which is probably one of the reasons that MSM has become popular in working with people with insulin resistance. The big thing, though, is to reduce their amount of glucose in the form and the steady stream of glucose. So, yeah, we need glucose to make energy, but the massive amounts of glucose that the average person eats, we already know we need to reduce. Okay? So that's the relationship with glucose metabolism. So who's at risk for sulfur deficiency? Athletes. Athletes are in an oxidative state, guys. You know, it's great to be an athlete, but some athletes are over-exercising and they're depleting their bodies of antioxidants, in particular the glutathione. Children can be at risk, and patients with HIV. So whenever we look at sulfur amino acid analysis and protein supplementation, it might be indicated to add extra protein for people who are at risk. So athletes who are working hard, you may want to add some branched chain amino acids to what they're doing. We may want to give them some extra protein supplements if they're over-exercising. And the same with children if they're picky eaters and are not eating good, easy-to-digest forms. What causes sulfur deficiency? Well, food processing methods, that's typical. Poor dietary habits. Chemical fertilizers can interfere with sulfur. And the natural sulfur cycle is interrupted by preventing crops from ingesting the mineral from the soil. So a lot of the conventional farming techniques where we're not putting back into the soil can create foods that normally should have high sulfur but don't. What's the cause of excess sulfur? Well, exposure to heavy metals. And then certain antibiotics are sulfur-containing, and people are sensitive to some of those and anti-inflammatories. Impaired ability to oxidize and detoxify sulfur compounds, right? So if somebody doesn't have really good strength in that sulfation pathway, in that ability to recycle everything, they're missing some nutrients or they have some genetic SNPs, that can be a problem. They can have sensitivity to sulfur drugs because of impairment in the conjugation of sulfation pathways in the liver. Remember, we have a phase 1 and a phase 2. The phase 1 is very simple. It's basically things get hydrolyzed. Phase 2, though, there's several different pathways, 6 or 7 exactly. So methylation, sulfation, glucuronidation, glutathione, and acetylation, and then I missed one. But sulfation is one of those. And we have to have the appropriate nutrients to be able to detoxify things, and we need to have enough sulfur. But if you're sensitive to sulfur drugs and you can't break down the sulfur and get rid of it, then you're going to have a buildup. So what's the impact? What are you going to see as a clinician, as a coach, as a practitioner if somebody's presenting with sulfur deficiency? None of these are specific to sulfur, but we always look at clues, right? We look at groups of symptoms and we look to what can these symptoms mean. So itchy skin or scalp, eczema, acne, diaper rash in babes, migraine headaches, flatulence, indigestion, vomiting, diarrhea, nerve degeneration, and lupus. All of these things can be a result of sulfur deficiency. And when you're analyzing to see what deficiency, what imbalance a person has, a great thing to use is the charts that we've given you that list the symptoms and you just go through and circle them, or the assessments that we've given you in the history-taking module where you actually can go through and have people circle and get scores for each of the nutrients. So if they have a lot of the sulfur deficiency signs, then you may be suspecting that. Some more hemorrhoids, impotence, painful and irregular menstruation, sore throat, toothache, nosebleeds, measles, joint pain, cardiovascular disease, and Alzheimer's disease. All of these things can be related to sulfur. If somebody has a toothache, does it mean they have a sulfur deficiency? No, not quite. It's when we put a lot of this together and we look at the whole person, we look at the whole history, we might be able to detect that they have a sulfur deficiency. And further, if you've done some methylation pathway analysis, some nutrigenomics testing, like the genes, like a 23andMe test or something along those lines, and they have a lot of impairment in the sulfation pathways, you might be suspicious that some of these symptoms are related. Sulfur excess, what can be that? Well, Crohn's disease can be a result of that. Nerve degeneration, ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a neurological condition. Asthma, when people have asthma, when they're exposed to sulfites, that may be that they have too much sulfur in the body. There's an impairment in the sulfur removal system, and that's very common in those sulfation pathways I showed you earlier. Inflammatory and vascular and joint degeneration, allergy to sulfur, skin irritations and kidney damage, all of these can be impacted by too much sulfur in the system. So it's not back to a more is good. So if somebody comes in and they tell you they're drinking smoothies three times a day and they're putting a tablespoon of MSM in each one, and they have some of these conditions or symptoms, you might suspect that there's too much sulfur. What are some of the genetic SNPs that are related to sulfur? Well, MTHFR is the inability to convert the homocysteine to methionine for transsulfation, and you'll have high homocysteine. What you're going to see, though, is that's related to the folate pathways, not enough folate. CBS. The CBS mutation, that's going to take the homocysteine down into the transsulfuration pathway. And it actually sometimes upregulates it. Sometimes it downregulates it and upregulates it. Let's just review upregulation and downregulation. Upregulation means it makes that pathway go too fast. Downregulation means it goes too slow. But what happens sometimes is if they have a CBS SNP that causes an upregulation of the transsulfation pathway, they could actually have an MTHFR, but you're not going to know it because their homocysteine is normal, because even though they're not going up and around, they're going down too much. What happens, though, is as it goes down too much and we have too much homocysteine going into the transsulfuration pathway, you can get high levels of an amino acid taurine, you can get high levels of ammonia, and you can get excess sulfur group and not have the elimination of this. Okay, so this is, can be a problem for some people. Now, when we get into more into the nutrigenomics and look at these pathways in detail, you will see that some people need to limit their sulfur intake if they have this CBS upregulation, because they are producing too many of these toxic byproducts. And there are ways to test for that, which we'll talk about when we get there. How do you assess for sulfur status? Well, you can look at the homocysteine level. That's an indirect measure. We can look at urine ammonia levels. We can look at urine amino acid testing, low levels of methionine and cysteine and cystine, and taurine could actually show that maybe there's a problem there, not enough sulfur. You can look at SpectraCell. You can look at the NutriVal by Genova and Metametrics, and doing a good history and looking at questionnaires and looking at scores. As far as sulfur, there's no official RDA. Most people, you know, the average daily intake is calculated to be between 800 and 900 milligrams. Under certain health conditions, like arthritis and liver disorders, you can actually get good results by increasing sulfur to 1,500 milligrams a day. The most common form of supplementing sulfur is MSM, methyl sulfonyl methane. And you've probably heard of this before. It was very popular for a while in the popular circles, the nutrition circles. Where do we get it? We get it in a lot of foods, the brassicas, asparagus, bean sprouts, all different kinds of beans. The brassicas like bok choy, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, collard greens, daikon, also in buckwheat. It's in egg yolks, garlic and onions, big source of it. green beans, greens, Jerusalem artichokes, jicama, kale, which is one of the cruciferous kelp, leeks, lentils, miso, onions, I mentioned, radishes, sesame seeds, sauerkraut, tofu. All these things are good sources of sulfur. Now, if you're talking to somebody and they say, oh, I just can't eat garlic and onion. Oh, no, I can't eat cruciferous vegetables. I just feel bad when I do. You might be suspicious that they have issues with sulfur excretion, that they get buildup of too much sulfur, and it can cause pathways to increase detoxification pathways, but not really have the full elimination. There's a lot of reasons. So I really would listen carefully when you're taking a history to see if the person is in this category where they may be having some issues with sulfur sensitivity. Some of the herbs that are high, turmeric, dandelion, catnip, echinacea, black pepper, chives, garlic, onions, carob, chocolate, horseradish, mustard, burdock, eyebright, parsley, ginseng. And one of the things that I've seen happen is people will get their genetic testing back and see that they have that CBS problem, and then they go, oh, I'm going to go off of all the sulfur foods. And they do, and they feel horrible because they're taking away, like, the bulk of really good nutrition. So everything in moderation is finding the right levels for your particular people. But again, when you have these lists and you start to see that people have problems when they eat these foods, you're suspicious that they're not eliminating their sulfur, that they may have a problem, a backup in that transsulfuration pathway. So how can you supplement sulfur? Well, NAC, N-acetylcysteine, and cysteine, remember, is one of the sulfur amino acids. Glucosamine sulfate. Glucosamine is used a lot when people have disc degeneration or joint degeneration to help rebuild the collagen. MSM, methylmalonylmethane. Thionine, taurine, and cysteine, just supplementing those amino acids. ALA, alpha-lipoic acid. The enzymes bromelain and papain, bromelain from pineapple and papain from papaya, they have good sulfur. Chlorella, DMSO, glutathione. Be careful with glutathione because people generally don't absorb glutathione as glutathione, and you want to make sure that if you are supplementing someone with glutathione, that you're giving a form that they can actually utilize, a liposomal form, a topical form, okay? IV form, or given in terms of NAC to generate it. Molybdenum. Molybdenum supports that sulfur pathway, so you can get up to 500 to 1,000 micrograms a day. And then to convert elevated cysteine to glutathione, 2-to-1 ratio of glutamine and glycine to allow the body to do the rest. So you don't necessarily have to be supplementing with the fully formed if the body's pathways are working. But if you're suspicious that the pathways aren't working, then you have to give it in this most active form. MSM, it's a volatile component in the sulfur cycle. It's another source of sulfur in the human diet. Increases in serum sulfate may explain some of the therapeutic effects of MSM, DMSO, and glucosamine sulfate. So some of those things, when you add them, it could be that the sulfur is actually supporting. Now, if you give someone MSM or DMSO or glucosamine sulfate and they feel worse, it could be that they have a backup in that transsulfation pathway. MSM can be effective for allergies, pain syndromes, athletic injuries, bladder disorders, and many more things that are related to structure and also to cleansing and detoxification. Other sulfur compounds you might see, isodenosyl, methionine, SAMe, and that's where we said that's the principal methyl donor in the body. Dimethyl sulfate, DMSO. DMSO is used a lot in dragging out heavy metals. We use it when we're going to do a challenged heavy metal urine test, which you have to be really super careful about with people with neurological impairment. Taurine, the amino acid taurine, glucosamine or chondroitin sulfate, reduced glutathione, and you can have clinical application in a lot of different places. So depression, fibromyalgia, arthritis, interstitial cystitis, athletic injuries, congestive heart failure, diabetes, cancer, AIDS. Sulfur is important. Not that it's the be-all and the end-all and the only thing, but consider it as part of this. If you're looking and seeing that somebody has, they're at risk for low sulfur. Sulfur can actually be applied topically, right? can be applied in cream, in a lotion. It's used in ointment for seborrheic dermatitis and scabies. It can be used in soap, in bar soap. It's sometimes used for acne. And it can be used in a bath. You can put 2 cups of magnesium sulfate, which is Epsom salts, with 15 gallons of water. I just dump it into a big old bathtub. You dissolve it in there in the warm water and soak it in. It gets in through the skin. There's a lot of sulfur baths. There's a lot of these hot springs and natural baths that are brimming with natural sulfur from the ground. You can tell when you're at one of those because they smell, that distinctive smell. What's the distinctive smell of sulfur? It's like rotten eggs because eggs are a high source of sulfur. We go in and say, hey, it smells like rotten eggs. It could be, you know, there's a high level of sulfur. And finally, sulfur, thiols, and mercury. What's the connection here? Well, a thiol is considered a compound that contains sulfur. So high levels of mercury, like in their teeth, and then they're chewing and it gets released, or in their brain, which is where mercury has an affinity for. If you eat foods that are high in thiols, it can mobilize the mercury, which might be good, right? Because we want to get that mercury out of the stores and out of the body. But if you inadvertently give people these high thiol level foods, the high sulfur foods, and you haven't opened up some of their elimination pathways, like say they're constipated, say their liver phase 2 is backed up, these high thiol foods, like the cruciferous, like the garlic, they mobilize mercury, but then they get symptoms because they're not eliminating it. They're not getting it out of the system. So it's really important that whenever you're stimulating something that mobilizes metals out of the body, that you're also working with them to open up the channels of elimination. You're getting them in saunas to sweat, getting them to do enemas to get rid of things, doing castor oil packs to work on the liver. 33 to 50% of mercury toxic people have been found to have high levels of cysteine, the amino acid cysteine. So those people might battle with sulfur foods. So the people who are having trouble with the sulfur foods, you want to make sure you do a really good history and find out what about the mercury. A lot of people know that they have mercury in their teeth with the fillings. What some people don't know is that if they've had crowns put on, and those crowns look, they look like they're ceramic, they look like the tooth, that a lot of them have mercury underneath and they don't even know it. And some people have a buildup of mercury from having been exposed early on and say they had their amalgams removed, but they didn't do any detox. So people who are mercury toxic are going to have a battle with the sulfur foods, because it's going to be putting a strain on those pathways. So you can, if you are planning to help somebody to get rid of mercury, like DMSO, or if they're doing some kind of chelation, or if they're getting their fillings removed, you want to make sure that you do this and test them for the sensitivity to sulfur foods, because you don't want to make them worse. Okay? And that's it. We've got some resources. We've got our book, our Advanced Nutrition and Human Metabolism book, and here's some articles that we've got links to: sulfur and chelation, general discussions on sulfur. The Weston A. Price has a good article on sulfur. Sulfur in Human Nutrition, that's a PubMed article. And Are We Getting Enough Sulfur? There's an article on that. So a lot of these went into creating this presentation. I want to thank you for being here, and we'll see you on the next video.